My dear brothers and sisters, in the early days of their marriage, Hannah and Elkanah enjoyed a wonderful life together. They were a devout and they were a godly couple, Levites descended from Kohath and through Korah, the Korah of Korah, Dathan and Abiram fame. And in the dangerous days of the judges, when there was so much lawlessness about, often barbaric events took place, and particularly where they lived in Benjamite territory. It seems that they shifted from Ramathaim Zophim and they came to live in Ramah, since that is described as where they went home to. And Hannah was delighted that Elkanah, the Levite, was the high-principled and the godly man that he was. And he was always a considerate and caring husband too, for he loved Hannah. He saw to it that they were consistent in journeying the 15 miles or so north to Shiloh to worship and remember at each of the three annual feasts. Elkanah was scrupulous in his duties, and Hannah enjoyed the journey with him. They were a faithful young couple. But, as it does, time went by and Hannah began to grieve over unrelieved disappointment. Years went by and she was not given the opportunity of motherhood. They longed and they kept trying for the baby to give fulfillment to their lives and provide the heir to continue the priestly line of Kohath. Hannah became withdrawn, introverted, consumed. You only had to look at her. Possibly reluctantly, maybe by mutual agreement between them, as had been done before, like Abraham and Sarah. But emphasizing the importance of this matter, Elkanah married a second wife, Peninnah, or Pearl as it means, such that when they undertook their journeys from Ramah to Shiloh, they made up a threesome. That has bells ringing about a famous modern marriage, doesn't it, where there were three in this marriage. It wasn't long before it became obvious that Peninnah was pregnant and the journey became difficult for her. And she gave birth to her firstborn. And whilst this may have solved one problem, Peninnah's fertility accentuated for Hannah her barrenness. And so her vexation and her fretfulness continued. It even became worse when, would you believe it, Peninnah was pregnant again, such that Elkanah, Hannah and Peninnah, Peninnah's firstborn, and now the one she carried, journeyed to Shiloh to worship. And so it went on until the journey was being made by Elkanah, Hannah and Peninnah and a whole brood of Peninnah's offspring. And all the time, Hannah's grief, Hannah's fretfulness and her inner feelings of failure and rejection grew. no doubt, on occasion, Peninnah was indiscreet in what she may have said in Hannah's hearing. Words aside, the very presence of Peninnah with all her offspring was enough to cause Hannah much pain. Actually, the Septuagint version puts a different light on it. There's no mention of the spiteful provoking and taunting of Hannah. I'll just read it to you. 1 Samuel chapter 1 verse 4. The day came and Elkanah sacrificed and gave portions to his wife Peninnah and her children. And to Anna he gave a prime portion because she had no child. Only Elkanah loved Anna more than the other. But the Lord had closed her womb. For the Lord gave her no child in her affliction. And according to the despondency of her affliction, and she was dispirited on this account, that the Lord shut up her womb so as not to give her a child. So she did year by year in going up to the house of the Lord, and she was dispirited and wept and did not eat. So the Septuagint does not give this personalized adversarial attitude of Peninnah to Hannah. But nevertheless, whichever is right, the adversity was there. And Hannah's unrelieved barrenness was enough to cause her this vexed and grief-stricken state of mind that she had. Over the years, the situation was psychologically destructive and physically so too. Some would say she became a cot case, unable to eat, continually weeping, and no one could do much to help her. An integral part of their worship at the tabernacle in Shiloh involved Elkanah preparing and roasting the peace offering, a feast in which all members of the family shared. It signified fellowship with the Almighty, fellowship with one's fellow worshippers. For Hannah, how could that work out? The blood of the offering was poured out at the foot of the altar. The fat was burnt on the fire. The breast and the right shoulder were the portions for the priests. And the rest belonged to the offerer. He and his family feasted, each receiving their portion. It may be, perhaps on this occasion, one of Eli's sons upset the ceremony by coming and digging his three-pronged fork into the flesh and taking it before it was cooked, grabbing his portion in advance. How degraded the priesthood had become. Whatever. But what should have been a joyful family fellowship meal was clouded over by disharmony. Crisis. For by this time, Hannah had hit rock bottom. Too distraught to eat, she was weeping and broken. And suddenly she leaves the group in the tabernacle precincts, and it seems that she went right to the entrance of the holy place. And there, verse 10, deeply hurt, Hannah prayed to the Lord and wept with many tears. Making a vow, she pleaded, Yahweh of armies, if you will take notice of your afflictions, your servant's affliction, remember and not forget me, and give your servant a son, I will give him to Yahweh all the days of his life, and his hair will never be cut. So this was not the removal of herself to avoid the open embarrassment of her distress, somewhere to cry in private where nobody could see, while the family continued their religious observances. Verse 12, she multiplied to pray, as the AV margin has it. And this was not trading with God, as if to say, if you'll give me the child for which I crave, and if you'll make it a boy, then this is what I'll do. This was the outpouring of a woman of faith who, distressed at what she saw around her as one of Israel, even here in Shiloh with the goings on of Eli's sons, she vowed that if God would give her the answer to her prayer, then she would fulfill a Nazarite vow. Her son, as a Kohathite, would be given to the Lord from the age of 25 through to 50, anyway. But now, with the knowledge and the consent of her husband, her child would be dedicated from conception for life, a servant like the high priest for the Lord. Underlying her prayer and her vow was her sorrow and disgust at the antics of Hophni and Phinehas, and complete lack of holiness and dedication for all to see, not to mention the situation with Peninnah. So she nominated the consecration of her son to live the dedicated life of holiness all the days of his life. It was not imposed upon her by the visit of an angel, as in the case of Manoah. It was Hannah's voluntary, free will declaration of open loyalty to the Almighty. Now, what Eli saw when she was there before the tabernacle praying, verse 13, he saw her lips moving, but he didn't hear her voice. Eli thought she was drunk and began to scold her. And he turned on her in that way. Hannah with dignity responded, No, my Lord, I am a woman with a broken heart. I haven't had any wine or beer. I've been pouring out my heart before the Lord. And so in her importunity, she emptied herself. I've been praying from the depth of my anguish and resentment. And Eli then responded, Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant the petition you requested from him. May your servant find favor with you, she replied. That's not quite the end. Her request for God's grace was accepted. And then Hannah went on her way. She ate, and she no longer appeared downcast. So what had changed? There was no baby conceived at this point. She could go back and she could eat with enjoyment, with a radiant face, and join the family. And everyone could see the difference. She was transformed. Her mind was renewed. And surely it was her utter faith and her trust. Eli's response. What had been spoken was enough. Well, after the birth, she named him Samuel, heard of God. Hannah gave her child a name which would be a continual memorial of God's answer to her prayer. And the close attention that she gave to nursing him, not only because he was dear to her, but because of her vow, he was dedicated, devoted to God. She refrains from attending Shiloh as if to say, when I come with you next time, I will hand him over to the Lord. And if Elkanah thought that what she was saying of one so young was a bit extreme, to say the least, his reply was careful and considerate. Do what you think is best, and stay here until you've weaned him. May Yahweh confirm your word. And so she stayed away from the meeting, though in spirit she was more there than anyone. And this period, normally weaning apparently in Israel, went on until about, it was about three before the child would be considered weaned. But it may have possibly included the time of nourishment and upbringing, even to the age of 12, according to a cross-reference with 2 Maccabees. And in our minds, I guess we can understand that and see it easier. What would a mother be doing with a three-year-old child, taking him and leaving him in a male environment to do serious work? When she had weaned him, whatever age that was, she took him with her to Shiloh, as well as a three-year-old bull, 2.5 gallons of flour and a jar of wine. Though the boy was still young, and the word is a youth, she took him to the Lord's house at Shiloh. And so the child was brought to Eli. Please, my Lord, she said, as sure as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this boy. And since the Lord gave me what I asked him for, I now give the boy to the Lord. For as long as he lives, he is given to him. And then Eli bowed and worshipped the Lord there. There is the background, there is the context for this wonderful prayer of Hannah's that follows, that we read at the beginning of chapter 2. And as you read it through, you can hardly fail to connect it with the song and the prayer of Moses that he sang as Israel came through the divided waters of the sea. And they all were delivered from the enemy that pursued behind. But the enemy could not get through because of the cloud that stood between them. And before Israel, there was the pillar of fire leading them on to the other side, to where they could see Moses. My heart rejoices in Yahweh. My horn is lifted up by Yahweh. My mouth boasts over my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There are so many connections between Exodus 15 and chapter 2 here that if that is right, and I feel absolutely certain that Hannah had this connection, she was picturing the events that she had been through as just like Israel in all their bondage and suffering, being delivered out of it by God. And for them, as they went through the path of the sea, walled either side with water that did not bury them, she sees her own life like that. And she sees her deliverance like that. Do not boast proudly, or let arrogant words come out of your mouth. Surely she was thinking of Peninnah. For Yahweh is a God of knowledge, and actions are weighed by him. She's learned to leave all of the judgment to him, for he knows best. The bows of the warriors are broken, but the feeble are clothed with strength. Those who are full hire themselves out for food. Those who are starving hunger no more. A complete reversal. The barren woman gives birth to 7. Actually, it seems that Hannah gave birth to 6. So 7 is used here probably as this perfect number. But the woman with many sons pines away. Maybe by this time, if not the taunting only, but maybe Peninnah was no more. Yahweh brings death and gives life. He sends some to Sheol. He raises others up. Yahweh brings poverty and gives wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the dunghill. He seats them with noblemen and gives them a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are Yahweh's. He has set the world on them. He guards the steps of his faithful ones, but the wicked are silenced in darkness. For a man does not prevail by his own strength. Those who oppose Yahweh will be shattered. He will thunder in the heavens against them. Yahweh will judge the ends of the earth. He will give power to his king. He will lift up the horn of his Messiah. And so this woman was looking forward to the kingship that was to come. And in those words, there is prophecy. If her thoughts connect with the deliverance of Israel, her words also connect with another woman that God chose, who sang and magnified Yahweh also. And we think of Mary when, at the early stages of her pregnancy, she went to visit her cousin Elizabeth, and the two of them, such faithful women, rejoiced together. Now, for most of us, I think the days of childbearing, child rearing are gone. But in those very things, we participate with all the elements of God's power and creation when we bring forth the fruit of the womb. If only we did that so purposefully and so carefully, as did Hannah and Mary. And if only we work consciously in that process with our Father in heaven.